This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Get involved in our Facebook page here. We have, as I've mentioned many times, that it's growing, it's expanding, and it's getting more interesting all the time. We have a raging, actually intelligent, articulate debate on voting for a third-party candidate, which I'm upholding that side of it. And we've got two of my most intelligent, most articulate, persuasive listeners have been having a running debate with me. So check out the Facebook territory, Facebook page for Occupied Territory. Just Google Facebook and Occupied Territory, and that'll take you straight there. And get involved. Post videos, any kind of news or information you want, and that's what you should do. Today we have, speaking of third-party candidates, we have a third-party candidate on the air today. So I'm practicing what I preach. We have a very good third-party candidate on the air today, and he will be here in just a moment. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and I told you before we're having a running, flaming battle here on Occupied Territory about ways to restructure our democracy, what's left of it, and our political system, what's left of it, such as it is, and when it's not taking to the streets, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the only way left, and electoral behavior, there is a third party. One could vote one's conscience, and one could vote for somebody who's not locked up by corporations. But, good to my word, I have finally contacted the best third party candidate I could possibly imagine. And they will be on today. We have with us Chris Cannon. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Sure. And you're calling from?
Vancouver, British Columbia.
Now, that's not part of the United States, right?
They wish.
I just want to make sure. You know, people should know who they're listening to. You're not a socialist or a communist or anything, right?
So that... No, we're here in Canada, and we're okay. Good, honest, democratic folk.
Okay, and I'm going to introduce you to people, and then we'll talk about the book that's come out, which is basically a political manifesto, and one that, I hate to use this word out loud, this phrase out loud, but here I'm going to do it anyhow. It actually makes you laugh out loud, this book, while making a good point. So if listeners, if you want to read something that's hysterically funny, but also very sharp and true, the book is called America But Better. America But Better, the Canada Party Manifesto. And it's got a foreword by Abraham Lincoln, which you don't find that too often. Anyhow, okay, Chris Cannon, who we're talking to today, is the co-author with Brian, is it Calvert or Calvert?
Calvert.
Calvert. In Eastern Canada would be Calvert?
No? Maybe on the Colbert Report.
Okay. Chris Cannon is co-author of a new book here, and it's called Canada But Better, which we mentioned.
America But Better.
America But Better, and the Canada Party Manifesto. And he's an American writer living in Vancouver and author of four books on music and travel. And his writing and photography have appeared in Rolling Stone, Billboard, Village Voice, The Globe and Mail, Sydney Morning Herald, NTV, etc. And he's a regular contributor to The Tyee, which is what?
The Tie is a progressive magazine in Vancouver. It's internet-based, but it has a very large reach. It's widely read in the United States as well.
Okay, T-Y-E-E, Tie. And a contributing editor at Vancouver Magazine. Let's see, a former sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, Chris served in the Presidential Honor Guard under George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, marched in Clinton's inauguration parade, and trained with the Marine Corps' legendary silent drill team. Originally enlisting for the infantry, Chris moved into intelligence and counterterrorism fields, graduating from Terrorism Counteraction School. Where is the Terrorism Counteraction School?
This particular school was in Okinawa, Japan.
With highest...
You do your research.
Well, no, actually, your publicist sent me your bio, but I can read. Terrorism Counteraction School with the highest scores in the history of the program, later authoring the Marine Corps' first domestic counterterrorism course following a 1995 bombing in his hometown. Oh, your hometown was Oklahoma City, really?
Yeah, I'm from Oklahoma City. My family is still there.
Okay. Chris is also a world-class ultimate frisbee player, competing in 5 national championships and 2 world championships. And he teaches courses and seminars on cultural criticism, satire, and magazine journalism at the University of British Columbia. This is a manifesto. And what is the book proposing, before we start off with details about the book?
Well, it's rather simply, we want to return America to the American people by way of the Canadian people. We are running the Canadian people as a whole for the office of President of the United States. So, you know, 33 million Canadian citizens can take the White House for a while and give America a rest, time to, you know, fluff her pillows and, you know, make you some soup and give you time to reevaluate your place in the universe.
Kind of a timeout, like if we were...
Yeah. Yeah. And right. Reach a little bit of an intervention.
You know, it's not a bad idea. I mean, if you read the I Ching or something like that, sometimes neutral or doing nothing is the way to go, right? While while somebody else, sort of the forces belong somewhere else. So Canada, you have maps in the beginning of this book. Can you? It's hard to describe a map, and maybe you could describe the maps. You could try anyhow, right? Now, you know what? Forget about that. In the beginning of the book, there are maps.
Look, there's 3 maps. You describe all the details in the maps, but there's 3 maps at the beginning of the book, and of course we label them really important maps. One is how America sees Canada, one is how Canada sees America, and the third is how Mexico sees both of us. So it's a little perspective.
Okay, and I think it really sets up the book pretty well. Also, the foreword by Abraham Lincoln is good. And so why does Canada, I mean, first of all, where do you get the nerve? And secondly, what to begin with does Canada have to teach the United States? We are the largest, most powerful. I can't even go on. Country in the world, but I mean, what do we have to learn from Canada? What do we have? We are exceptional. This is an exceptional country. American exceptionalism, and we have conquered everything, and now we almost have no worlds to conquer, like Alexander. You know what I mean? But
right. So
we're turning on ourselves, which is something maybe you want to. What about guns? What happens in Canada as far as gun control and guns?
Thank goodness. Yeah, well, you've got about 5 questions stacked up there.
Which one
you want me to take care of?
Why don't you start off with a general description of what it is that Canada could possibly teach the United States about democracy and how to run a country?
Well, it's not really about, you know, Canada coming down and teaching the United States or taking control of the United States and, you know, subsuming the American people to Canadians' will. It's not really that. Canada and America have so much in common. We have we face the same issues. We're causing the same problems. We have the same problems with the leadership in Canada that Americans have in the United States.
Oh, right.
And so it's really more about trying to put control back in the hands of the people. And, you know, again, the American people by way of the Canadian people first. So it's not that Canada has anything new to teach America. We just believe that maybe a little bit of an intervention is called for, and the Canadian people can help remind the American people how great they are and how much they have to offer, and that America's best days don't have to be behind it. America's best days can be in front of it.
Does Canada believe that America has lost its way?
Yeah, well, not just America. Canada's lost its way. A lot of, you know, the world in general has lost its way. A lot of these problems in the United States are international problems. Mm-hmm. So I think as a species, we've kind of lost our way. And, So, you know, we're trying to reclaim a little bit of that. And when, if you can get America to be the ones in the forefront of that, then the rest of the world will follow. The world likes following America when it's making sense. So we kind of want America to make sense again.
It seems like it's a long time since it's been that way, right? I mean, what we have to go back before the 60s, maybe, at least?
I don't know. It comes and goes. I think it's cyclic. It's not like, you know, looking back to the glory days of yesteryear and how we've lost all that wonderful, you know, that nostalgic feeling for how great things used to be. There were a lot of problems in the 50s and 60s as well. Mm-hmm. Even while you have great problems, you also have great strides for humanity. So I think it's cyclical, and when things look their worst, oftentimes it means things are on the border of being their best. The only thing that we lack is political will, and it's the will of the people that's going to make the difference.
Well, let's start off maybe with some specifics, then we can sort of go back and forth between generalizations and specifics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, you have trouble up there with, you don't have the same polarization we have in this country where everybody's at each other's throats 24/7 in the most violent manner, almost. I mean, do you have political differences, but is it as bad as here?
Well, a lot of that in the United States is because of the media, the 24-hour entertainment cycle, journalists being systematically replaced with pundits. We don't quite have that up here. There's actually a law in Canada that you're not allowed to lie on TV, which is why we have no Fox affiliates in Canada.
Wait. You're not allowed to lie on TV?
You're not allowed to lie in the news in Canada. I don't know the exact specifics of that law, but there are restrictions to actually lying on the news. So there's still a little bit more integrity in journalism in Canada, and so the polarization in the media has not gotten to such a point. But in politics, it certainly is there, and possibly even worse, because there is a strong majority government here that's pretty much imposing their will on the Canadian people. And there's a lot of opposition to that, too, particularly with the rise of the oil sands and the dismantling of environmental laws in Canada. So, you know, Canada's got issues, too. So this book isn't at all about, hey, Canada's so great and America needs to follow our lead. It's more about, hey, let's get together and solve our problems together because we have so much in common.
Well, obviously the book is a serious book, but it's written in a satirical manner. I mean, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes, obviously, sometimes the only thing left or the only thing that does make sense is satire when you're dealing with an extreme situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to know who enforces this. You can't lie on. I mean, do you have a Department of Honesty? I mean, who enforces? I'm serious. Who enforces? Fox News. Like, first of all, news down here is business. It was once business and it was news. It was never not business. I mean, Walter Cronkite was rich and so was CBS. You know what I mean? But at least people did take it for granted. And I think if they even bothered to check into it, that he wouldn't say something probably if it wasn't sort of or generally or absolutely true. Somewhere we lost our way, probably in the 70s and 80s when everything seems to have gone off the track. But over there, do you have private media there or is it government media like BBC?
Well, let me take a step back real quick. I don't think America lost its way or the media lost its way at any point in time. I think, again, that those kinds of things are cyclical. People get you get off track a bit and then people catch on and they kind of demand excellence and then bring it back. I think if you are going to name a point in time, it's probably innocently the beginning of the 24-hour news cycle, late 80s, early 90s, Russian Gulf War, CNN, which, you know, embedded journalists, all that kind of thing, which was the beginning of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle. But then over time, as more of those, as you have more and more stations vying for that, it becomes more entertainment-based. You get more punditry than journalists, and that's where it kind of went off the rails in the late 80s. Now, in terms of Canadian law, Canadian content, Canadian media, there are similarities and there are differences, and I'm not really a policy wonk, so I don't think I have answers to your questions about very specific policies in Canada.
But do you have an equivalent of National Public Radio?
Yeah, we're the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Which is owned by the government or what?
CBC, is it owned by the government? I don't know if CBC is owned by the government. It's the closest thing you would say is NPR or PRI.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it's either owned by the government or largely, I don't think it's owned by the government, but I think it's largely government funded.
That's how ours is.
But it's been slashed over the last few years, too.
Yeah, that's how ours is. But, you know, down here in liberal left land, which is where I live,
What'd you call it?
Liberal Leftland.
But Liberal Leftland?
Leftland.
Leftland. Oh, is that New York you're referring to? Or just a neighborhood in New York?
No, it's a vast army of people spread across the country.
Spread across Morningside Heights?
We're on the upper left side.
I went to Columbia.
So then you know, we're on the upper left side. I'm even broadcasting from the upper west side. That's how bad it gets, right?
So, I love the upper west side.
Okay, and you know, I was on BAI for 25 years, Pacific Station. So, but here, when I say here, I mean among people like myself and a lot of my listeners, and in fact, a whole lot of other people. I'm also on satellite radio, Sirius XM satellite, and people listen to me. The biggest group of listeners are not Democrats or liberals anymore to left-wing radio. They're independents.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this is to say the people here have contempt for NPR.
Mm.
When I say here, I mean among the group that I'm living with, and it's a pretty big group. But they think it's just bland and basically a kind of a corporate shadow. I mean, is the CBC like that up there?
I don't want to compare NPR to CBC in that sense because I love NPR. I've always listened to NPR, whatever city I lived in. When I lived in New York, I listened to it. There's great NPR stations in Boston. In Chicago, after I moved out of Chicago, I continued through the internet listening to the NPR stations there. There's so much great programming in NPR, and it's two different complaints about whether it's a corporate shell or whether it's bland programming. Those are two entirely different ways of addressing it.
Well,
love NPR, and CBC does have some similarities to NPR. Probably not the range of programming, but it is also a wonderful institution, and I think both of them are vital to the democracies of their country.
Well, looking at the book here, we have timeline of Canadian history. We have various references. But for instance, Canada, let's say Canada as a candidate, and maybe you could call yourself a temporary press spokesperson for Canada as a candidate, just for
purpose. Now, Brian and I usually do these things together, and I'm more of a kind of the dark lord of the Sith behind the scenes, and he's kind of
he's a performer, is he?
Yeah, he's an actor, and I'm a writer. He's also a writer, terrific sketch writer. And
also, you guys have fantastic YouTube videos with this stuff, right?
Oh yeah, we did it all on our own. We've done a couple of projects together over the years, a number of short films and film races and things like that. And we do it for fun, and we do it because we believe in what we're doing. And this project just seems to have taken off, and so we've latched onto it with both hands, and we're enjoying the ride and hoping we can make some sort of difference.
Now, for instance, let's take some specific issues. I mean, the environment is a total disaster, as you can see from the tremendous drought we're having here, and and you do have similar problems up there. In other words, you've got the XL pipeline. We have the XL pipeline. The pipeline is actually the origin of the pipeline is up where you are. You know, the pipeline just runs from Canada with those horrible tar sands down to here. So that must be a big problem up there. I know that recently in Canada, they took steps to try to almost classify people who protest the pipeline as terrorists.
Yeah, that's one of the issues. I think it's one of the overarching issues from our perspective is how language is displayed in the media. We've lost all respect for any sort of common ground in argumentation. So we've gone past the point of logical argumentation. So you will have, locals who are protesting an environmental issue that affects their local community, but they'll be painted by outside interests as, well, they're the foreign terrorists and we're the benevolent corporate entity. And, often the reverse is true. And local environmentalists in Vancouver, or not Vancouver, local environmentalists in Canada have been painted as basically as foreign terrorists by a company that, by organizations, corporations that are drilling very dirty oil and selling it and call themselves ethical oil. They've branded themselves ethical oil. So it's the powerful use of terminology in the last 20, 25 years where I think corporations have realized that they can simply turn meaning on its head and convince people of really anything.
Well, since you're the writer, I mean, basically that's a whole other discussion, which is, elemental to everything else. I mean, basically there's been a distortion and perversion of language to the point where it's almost like Orwellian, right? Black means white, good is bad.
Exactly, and it's a very powerful tool, and I think that's why you have this rise of satire over the last 10 years. You have the popularity of Stephen Colbert and Daily Show in particular, but others, like The Onion and that kind of thing. I mean, earlier this year, there was a, I believe it was a Louisiana congressman who retweeted an Onion headline that Planned Parenthood was opening abortion plexus.
That's right.
It's a very funny story, and he retweeted it as if it were a true story. I don't know if he tweeted it, but he Facebooked it or something like that, put it out in the public sphere as if it were a true story. And that just speaks to how we've lost our grasp of common language. And when you do that, you can no longer have rational argumentation. That the whole structure of rational argumentation, of logical argumentation, having rational discussions, is that you agree on your terminology. If you don't agree on your terminology, you cannot have a rational debate.
But here,
we've lost the capacity for that, and that is why satire has come to the fore as a new rhetorical strategy, because logical argumentation just doesn't seem to work anymore as a rhetorical strategy.
Well, so you're the one, for instance, who's responsible for things in the book, like using commas could change everything. Like, you have one sentence in there that says... it says, let's eat, comma, zombies. Or no, let's eat, comma, humans.
Let's eat people.
Let's eat, comma, people.
Yeah, it's the difference between let's eat people with no comma, which is, you know, let's go out and eat people, and let's eat, comma, people, saying people, let's come on, get together, let's go eat. And that's how commas can prevent a zombie apocalypse.
So you would preach the use of correct grammar and punctuation.
It's not that the world's falling apart because we're not placing our commas correctly. It's that we have to pay attention to our language, we have to pay attention to meaning. And that particular example is from our chapter on making English the official language for native English speakers. We believe, you know, if the United States does want to make English the official language, you know, it comes up in Congress every year, bills to make English the official language of the United States. And we understand the perspective of that, and we would support that as long as it included a rule that native English speakers have to pass, you know, if foreign English speakers have to pass ESL, you know, English as second language courses, then native English speakers should have to pass English as a primary language, you know, EPL courses, you know, including, you know, some of the sample lessons that we have are, like you had mentioned, let's eat people, how commas can prevent a zombie apocalypse, and where you at, grammar that breaks the heart, and you're welcome with a your YOUR as opposed to YOU apostrophe RE, homonyms that will make people stop thanking you. So it's just a little playful to make us understand. And if you're going to try and do something like make English the official language of the United States, we should probably have some standards for that English.
I have tremendous respect for the correct use of language. Although I had a terrible education, I went to an awful college, so my grammar is no, I'm serious. It really was an awful college. So I'm basically self-educated. So my grammar is anywhere from dots and dashes, like saline or non-existent. You know what I mean? But I do love the correct use of language. I was talking about this on a show here previously about, you know, people can't speak right anymore. When you combine that with a real... But it doesn't seem to matter here. I don't know what's like up where you are, but it doesn't matter here anymore. Any kind of debate has, because of people like Sarah Palin and George Bush, because people like this, increasingly the Tea Party people, are attacking the elites, which often means they can actually speak well or understand things, you know? I mean, there is a rebellion down here, and almost a successful rebellion, which infects politics, certainly culture, against intelligence, against learning.
Right. And this we have a chapter about that in our book. It's called The Elitist Scourge, How to Hate People Who Are Better Than You. And there's a crucial element in here. At a certain point, we stopped, or not we, but the ones that are attacking education and knowledge and intelligence, at a certain point, they stopped using the word elitism and started using the word elite. And it's really different. If you're attacking elitism, I can understand that. You're attacking people who have no connection to the common person, who think they're the best that they have to offer, and therefore they can do no wrong, and their opinion is always right. That's radically different than someone who is regarded as elite, an elite member of society. Those are the people you want running the country. So when you stop attacking elitists and start attacking them as elites, and that's the word that over the past year and a half, I think as soon as Rick Santorum got into the argument, they stopped using the word elitism and started complaining about the elites. Well, the elites are the people you want running the country, not the elitists, but the elite, the best you have to offer. Those are the people you want running the country. So attacking that is... it's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
But it appeals to the base, I guess.
The base. But the base has now become, I don't know what it would be, but the base has now become the top, and the top has sunk to the base. In other words, the base has expanded so much in this country that it doesn't even matter anymore. You had George Bush, who was attacking the elites, when in fact he is the elite, and we've lost complete sense over here now. You know,
elite politically, elite by connection. That's not the same as elite by education, intelligence, and rationality. That's a whole different type of elite.
Well, don't you think that's almost it's quixotic, you know, to at this point in our devolution to be attacking people? I mean, I'm with you completely, right? You know, I hate the debasement and the ruination of good language, but. I mean, it's almost like a hopeless course. Here's something: if you combine it with the relentless advertising that's everywhere and the money, this is something based on what we were just talking about. Here's a big ad from the New York Times just the other day, and you see this on TV in this country anyhow. I don't know what it's like where you are, but in the paper, big ad. It says, and I'm going to read it here. It's very short. Let's solve 17th place. It says, in 2009, the Program for International Student Assessment ranked U.S. students 17th in the world in science. We can do better. Let's invest in our teachers. Let's inspire our students. Let's get America back on track. This is brought to you by Exxon Mobil. Exxon Mobil brings you this. If it wasn't for Exxon Mobil soaking up all the government subsidies, and in fact, if they didn't, because they don't pay their taxes, we can't afford to have teachers. I mean, this is how bizarre the world has gotten.
Yeah, you know? Well, it's rhetoric. It's an attack on language. It's an attack on the meaning of the terms that we use for logical argumentation.
What would you do as a candidate? What would you do about gay marriage and would you put a constitution? What about the marriages between a man and a woman? I mean, how do you deal with that as a gay candidate? From Canada.
Well, the cornerstone of the argument against allowing homosexuals to marry is that sexual promiscuity among the gay community will somehow destroy traditional marriage. And speaking to what we were talking earlier about, you know, the dissolution of language, somehow through some mathematical formula we can't even grasp, this means that the best way to stop gays from having multiple sexual partners is to deny them the one institution that would prevent them from having multiple sexual partners.
Right.
And we accept some people never accept gay marriage, but if you are going to say that gay marriage destroys traditional marriage, what we want to do, our plan is to turn that on its head and say, okay, we will allow one gay couple to marry for every straight couple that gets divorced. And that way, by the way, congratulations, Las Vegas, you're now the gayest city in America. That way, it turns that formula on its head. A traditional marriage has to break down before a gay marriage can happen, and that way it reverses that correlation. You can't say that gay marriage is destroying traditional marriage if you allow a traditional marriage to fail first and then allow one gay couple to marry. That way it's a direct correlation and reverses that formula.
This seems completely shrewd and justified. I think it's a great point to be running on, and based on that, in terms of the numbers, there would be a tremendous increase almost immediately.
And
gay marriage. I mean,
even that'll be contentious, and we have a backup plan. If that's just too contentious and people won't buy into it, then we have what we call our Children of Men policy. And that, since all gay babies come from straight couples, we will simply declare all straight marriages illegal. So only gays will be allowed to marry because they're the only couples that have the proven ability to not conceive gay babies. So within a generation, the entire argument will be rendered moot.
This is good. Also, you have little things scattered throughout the book. Here's something called, and they're called CanaFacts. C-A-N-A facts. Here's another one. Canada legalized gay marriage to preserve body heat during ice fishing excursions.
Mm-hmm.
Canadian men love dipping their poles in ice holes. So there's little helpful facts here throughout the book.
It's good to know your neighbors.
What about sex education in schools?
Sex education. We believe that sex education in schools should admit that there is something known as sex.
Good start.
Sex education tends to ignore that salient point. And we also believe that sex education should stop resembling a kindergarten puppet show. If you can teach them about adult themes, you have to teach them as adults.
What about the scourge of marijuana? How do you deal with that as a candidate?
Scourge of marijuana.
I'm just, you know, I'm in the media. I get to say anything I want. Go ahead. The scourge.
Well, you know, we have this, it's funny, we have this repeating phrase. Whenever that comes up, we just look at each other and say, seriously, America? Seriously? I mean, come on. We have a chapter on that, too. The chapter's called Weed, Sweet, Sweet Weed.
Well, it does. One of the problems here, which is a very sad, overwhelming problem, because everything is for profit here, is this for-profit prison system we have. And you know.
Oh, that's true. And that's intimately tied to the war on drugs from the 80s that really criminalized marijuana. And now you have, I hate to just shoot out figures off my memory, but we do have them in the book. We actually mention marijuana in several chapters, not just, you know, as a, you know, good time Canadian thing to do, mm-hmm. which it is, but that it's also is the root of a lot of other problems. You have, I believe it's more than 50% of the prisoners in American prisons are there for nonviolent crimes, a lot of them drug-based, a lot of them marijuana-based. And if you release, if you were to reverse, stop criminalizing marijuana, you'd give a lot of people their lives back, and you would stop, you would go a long way to stop supporting for-profit prisons who use their profit to push for legislation to make prison sentences harsher so they can keep the bed space filled and make more money.
Yeah, I mean, legalizing marijuana would put a lot of big industries out of business, and I'm not just talking about Mexican, you know, marijuana gangs. It would put a lot of American businesses way out of business. I mean, what about?
Well, ironically, it would be devastating to the Canadian economy if, especially if California legalized marijuana. British Columbia would take a huge hit because so much of it comes from BC.
Is that right?
So it's a huge part of the economy. I mean, you know, the underground economy, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you're losing a lot of money up here. So on the one hand, we're in favor of, you know, the common sense, rational approach to marijuana. And there are objections to it, and there's some valid objections, too. But you can't just completely blanket make it all illegal when there's very valid points towards medical marijuana and things like that. There are certain measures you can take up to a certain point. Like, we believe that the you legalize marijuana and make the minimum purchase age 35. And then it's just marijuana is no longer a gateway to other drugs. It's a gateway to middle age and relieving your back pain.
Well, you know, it's also like prohibition. I mean, you know, you can't outlaw something that tens of millions of people are doing. It never works. But what about the main thing I have arguments with people when they call up on the satellite program is I go on about single payer. I mean, I'm always, you know, demanding that we should have single payer. I think this Obamacare, to use a phrase, it's kind of just a concession to lobbyists and insurance companies and drug companies. I don't really believe in it, but it's obviously it's better than nothing, and a lot of people will get helped. But it's not single payer, and I get a lot of people calling up. It's a national program. People in Canada listen to me too, and they say, "Do you realize that your socialist comments, blah blah blah, that people in Canada have to wait 5 years to see the dentist?" I mean, they go on and on and on like this. You know, what I mean,
that's not true.
So does it really work? Does it work better up there than our system?
Well, I want to avoid comparing U.S. and Canada and say Canada's great and U.S. sucks.
You want to avoid doing that, but you wrote a whole book called America But Better?
Right, but it's not about Canada being better than America.
It's about
Canadians and Americans working together to make America the great country that used to be and maybe even a little bit better.
And so, the book has suggestions, basically, right?
Yeah, it's a policy. It's a manifesto. Okay. So we have a lot of policy issues in there. And the Canadian healthcare system is, you know, objectively, you know, it's usually ranked, you know, one of the best of the world and generally considered one of the best of the world. And for the most part, Canadians are very happy with their healthcare, particularly if they spend time in other countries, live in America for a while or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't have, you know, we do have waiting lists for bionic hair and solid gold hip replacements, but you don't have Canadians dying of a sore throat.
Mm-hmm. And how are the hospitals up there? Because down here, the hospitals are getting worse all the time. People die when they go into hospitals down here. Well, I'm serious. They do. You know.
Yeah. There's issues with the hospital industry the world over. I don't want to get too deep into the technical details because, again, I'm not really a policy wonk. I can tell about my personal experience, but I don't want this to become about me.
Well,
it's really about the Canadian people.
You also mentioned here, America is obviously this American exceptionalism thing is just pure, you know, ignorant arrogance. There's no other word to describe it or phrase to describe it. But it seems to me that America has done so much. We're almost like Macbeth, right? I mean, you know, you teach literature, cultural criticism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Macbeth. America has waited. What is the phrase? I have to paraphrase Shakespeare. You know, I'm so waited so deep in blood that to go back would be the same as going forward at this point. And because you have a chapter in here about how to say you're sorry. I'm going to read the title of it. It's called, well, it's not a chapter, but it's a portion of a chapter. How to Say You're Sorry Without Looking Like a Total Pussy. So what is that?
That's a whole chapter on that.
All right, what is that about? What is that? What do you mean there?
Well, you know, I think if there is one thing that again, I don't like to say, you know, Canadian superiority, and we want to import this to America, but I think if there's just one detail that, and this comes from being an American and having moved to Canada and living here now. I'm a very proud American. I was very proud to serve in the Marine Corps. I love my country. I love the United States. There is one thing that America lacks that Canada can really help, and that is the concept of humility. You cannot consider yourself, the doctrine of American exceptionalism. You can't call yourself the greatest country in the world if you're not willing to look at your faults and say, yeah, you know what, we messed up there, and we need to fix this. We're not the greatest. You can't say we're the smartest people in the world if you're ranked in the teens and the 20s in your children's scores. You can't say you have the greatest healthcare system in the world if you have an infant mortality rate worse than, I think it's about 40 or 50 other countries mm-hmm. out there, and if more than half the bankruptcies in the United States are partially attributable to medical expenses. And if I remember my facts correctly, Americans spend about twice as much on health care per capita as any other country on Earth.
True.
And so it's the greatest... you could say it's the greatest medical system in the world if you can afford it, but the vast majority of Americans can't, and that I think that's behind the push for some sort of socialized medicine.
Mm-hmm. What about the Democratic vote here? Everything okay with the two-party system? I mean, you have a two-party system up there?
No. I believe there's five parties up here or something like that, and generally mm-hmm. three of them are vying for power. I think Mexico has seven parties, if I'm not mistaken. America is fairly mired in the two-party system, and that's why we have a chapter in here on trying to... When you have that, it's kind of a two-dimensional system. Everything is broken down into binary. You know, you have patriots and you have terrorists, you know. And so we actually have a chapter where... called the Cameron Plan, American 3D. It's where we get James Cameron to go to Congress, and if any issue that the Senate and Congress can't solve within 30 days, and 30 days, you know, meaning, you know, 3D, James Cameron gets to step in, and he has broad legislative powers to force the two parties to look into a third dimension and realize there are other options.
Well, it really is a source of tremendous despair among people here who truly are, and they also love their country. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's plenty of quotes, but why go through them all? About, you know, somebody who's really angry at the government is probably more and criticizes it routinely might even be more of a patriot than anybody who just blindly upholds it, as you were mentioning before.
Right. Well, but, you know, the government has become a dirty word, and government should not be a dirty word. The government is the people, and I think that's our overarching thesis. Is we want the people to take back their government, take back their media. The problem is not with the government or the corporations. The problem is with the will of the people. And when you have nearly half your country that does not turn out for elections, especially presidential elections, there is really nowhere else to point the blame. If there is that much apathy among the populace, if there's that much of a lack of political will, mm-hmm. then you're just going to continue being commodified and owned by the corporations and the lobbyists and the people who own the politicians.
Well, why do you figure people here don't turn out to vote? And it gets worse all the time. Why is that, do you think?
Why do people not turn out to vote?
In America. Because they do it like 80-90% in some European countries. What is our problem here? Why don't people turn out to vote?
That's a good question, isn't it? If people had that answer, they'd be able to capitalize and get people out to vote.
Well, now I reveal that it's slightly rhetorical question. One of the reasons I think they don't turn out to vote is because of experience that they have voted over and over and over again, especially at a national level, and just seen their government get worse and more controlled by corporations. And they said, what's the point? I might as well just go, watch TV that day.
Yeah, well, that's apathy. I mean,
but it's caused by experience. It's not just, you know, somebody just woke up with apathy in the morning. I mean, if you vote for a Democrat or a Republican over the last 40 or 50 years here, it just gets worse anyhow.
Well, you're assuming that the people who are not voting now, the nearly 50% of people who don't vote in U.S. Elections, you're assuming that there are people who used to vote. But it's always been that way. In fact, in the last presidential election in the United States, I think was record turnout, like 62% or something like that, which was a record for voting in the presidential election. And you're going to see that go down a lot this time. A lot of that was because of the enthusiasm that Obama brought to the table. They had these very high expectations. He was, the great White House hope. And mm-hmm. it's just impossible to meet those expectations. And so you have that lack of enthusiasm this time around. You're probably going to see those voting numbers go down.
Are the voting numbers higher in Canada for national elections?
Traditionally, yeah. For the 2008 election, there was also an election here in Canada, and for the first time in history, the American turnout was actually larger than the Canadian turnout. It was something like, and I'm pulling these numbers out of my butt, you know, I give like plus or minus five percentage points, but the American election was in the 60s percentage of the electorate, and the Canadian election was in, I believe, the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that the American election had a greater turnout than Canadian election. But Canadians have, it's a different system up here. They have elections more or less after every meal, and it's very easy for people to get tired of it. And I think that was the case there.
Last question then, because there's some other things I need to get to. By the way, if you just tuned in, those of you on the podcast, we'll have plenty of time to figure this out.
Hello,
you,
podcasters. What's up then?
We're listening to Chris Cannon, who co-authored with Brian Calvert the book America But Better, which I recommend everybody to buy because we all need a good laugh. It's brilliant satire and very well written.
Funny
drawings and really terrific stuff, and also very righteous and very direct about how it addresses real things. I mean,
so, very righteous. I love that. Righteous.
Well, this is from the 60s. You know, what can I say? I mean, I'm leftover. I have leftover language, you know.
I love it. That's great.
Leftover language.
It's not to use words. We should be more righteous. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
we've made some wonderful words dirty words. Like, I mean, government should be a wonderful word.
So should liberal. So should liberal. You know.
Liberal. Education.
Yeah.
Contraception. These all used to be good words, positive words, and now they're all demonized. I mean, we tackle this in the last chapter of our book. It's all about the language and how we've lost control of the language, and it's the war of the words. We're pitching right now a second book, like a follow-up book, in a completely different style. I can't really go into the details, but based on our last chapter, which is Living in Fear, the War of the Words, which is what we were talking about earlier on how the language has been manipulated to such a point that we can't even have a conversation anymore. That's kind of our key points are in the last chapter, Living in Fear, the War of the Words.
Well, here's another can of fact from – oh, no, you have another thing. Aside from can of fact, you have things here. It's a promise, like a campaign promise.
Right. We have – in every chapter, we try to have one can of fact, which is just kind of a detail about Canada that you may not have known. And then we also – in every chapter, we have one campaign promise that is generally related to the chapter.
Got to make a campaign promise. And it has an old-fashioned fist with the index finger sticking out, which is great. I love that.
We also have one of our videos. We've made four or five videos, and one of them is just campaign promises. check that out. Our website is americabutbetter.com, and it's got some links on the right side that has our Flickr account where we have our campaign posters, and we encourage people to print them out and hang them up and take pictures and put them on our Facebook page, which people have done, which has been awesome. We have a guy in Tennessee who taped our campaign posters to the back window and to the front hood of his Mini and went driving around Tennessee with, you know, the Canada Party posters and, you know, put them on our Facebook. We love that. That's fantastic. And so we have that. We also have a YouTube link there where you can go to all of our videos.
Yeah, the videos are great. I like
them. Thank you. And one of our videos is just 30 seconds of campaign promises.
here's a campaign promise from science, the chapter Science versus Religion.
Mm-hmm.
The spoiler says science wins in overtime. Mm-hmm. It's a promise. Anyone who questions evolutionary genetics will have to explain a Neanderthal uncle in every family. This is important, right? So let me ask you a last question here. If Canada becomes the president of the United States, does hockey have to become our national game?
Oh, yeah. We do have a chapter on that as well. I'm sorry, baseball. I know you're America's pastime, but you know, the past is kind of where that belongs. It's time for a real sport, and hockey. hockey is Canada's theater of war. I mean, the concept of sports as a metaphor for war goes back as far as sports metaphors and wars. In Canada, I think the reason Canadians are so polite and so nice is because we consolidate all of our anger and hatred and bitterness into these 60 seconds or 60 minute sessions on a Saturday afternoon where you're just out for blood. And then afterwards, you're like, hey, help me reattach my arm. Let's go get a beer. You know, it's all done. It's left it on the ice, and we have a policy of when we assume the presidency that we will go to the United Nations and request that wars now be settled on the ice, that we have international hockey games and everything be settled in a hockey game, and you know, Israel and Palestine could go back and forth year after year, because hockey games, you know, it's always like a very narrow point differential, and so chances are, say if Israel and Palestine, they play a hockey game every year for control of the West Bank, it would probably go back and forth year after year, and the end result is that they are actually sharing it, and you know, problem solved, you leave it on the ice, get on with your lives.
Well, this is obviously, you know, the closest thing we have to that is football, but I don't think people are as amicable afterwards as they are.
Not so much. No, but which Canada brought you, by the way?
Is that right? Okay, it's football.
Basketball and football, yeah.
Interesting, really.
It was a form of rugby that Canada brought to the United States, and then the United States took out all the footy parts and then called it football, which we don't really understand.
I'm actually a big hockey fan. The Devils are my team. The Jersey Devils are my team.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's too bad. Well, it's because they're sticking with all these old veterans, you know.
I've always been a Detroit Red Wings fan, but living in Vancouver now for 7 years, I'm a huge Canucks fan. Those guys are so great. They're so nice. The fan base is so awesome. So we're huge Canucks fans, and we're during the Stanley Cups, you might have, I don't know if you were following us then, but you might have seen us tweeting quite a bit.
I did.
So
but
we love the Canucks.
Yeah, but how do you explain what happened with that big riot?
Oh, well, now, let's touch on that for a second.
All right, let's do it.
Big riot. I don't know if you might have seen like some clips from the riot, but I would barely call it a riot. Now, this is somebody, I have a background in counterterrorism. I understand the situation.
Okay.
A riot in Canada is not the same as a riot in the United States. There was what you had in Vancouver was a lot of disappointment over, let's be honest here, some pretty crappy officiating through the Stanley Cup process.
Okay, I'll go along with that.
You had a lot of frustration. What you also had was simply a lot of people downtown to party, and you had some instigators and troublemakers who really didn't have anything to do with the hockey. They just saw an excuse to go around and try to start some trouble. And for the most part, you had some broken windows and a couple of fights, but you didn't have murders and rapes and the kind of things you had traditionally associate with riots, like the LA riots. They don't even compare. I mean, in Canada, this was just more of a heavily populated skirmish. And
well,
you know
is,
what?
Yeah.
What you don't see and what the American media, I doubt, reported very well was the next morning, thousands of people went downtown, walked the streets, cleaning up glass, sweeping up glass, helping business owners, picking up trash. That's the Canadian spirit. There were some troublemakers. They've largely been brought to justice or in the process of being brought to justice. Just a couple hundred of them, really. Most people just kind of stood on the sidelines, took video footage, and then sent it to the police. So there was a real community policing aspect. You didn't have cops beating people. You didn't have huge gangs getting into fights or that kind of thing. And the next day, you had thousands of Vancouver citizens voluntarily going en masse downtown to clean up the mess and say, this is our city, we're going to reclaim it. That was embarrassing last night.
That's why American is exceptional, because the next morning we just burn more cars and beat more people up, and that's why we're exceptional.
It doesn't have to be that way, and I don't think the average American is like that. I think if the average American felt comfortable and safe going out the next day as members of the community to clean up the streets, I think they would do that. The American people are a wonderful people. It's just more about that that community relationship, building on that sense of community. Vancouver in particular has a very strong sense of community, a very strong sense of community spirit. So you feel safe going out the next day, and you know there's going to be other people out there cleaning up and such. And so the Vancouver riots were reported in the media as, okay, a riot, and so you put that in your head along the lines of, you know, the LA riots, things like that. You know, I was right here, and it was absolutely nothing like that.
Well,
if anything, it gave Canadians a chance to demonstrate their community spirit by going out and taking care of it.
All right, we're at the end of the show here. Again,
okay.
Let me just mention the book again. The authors are Chris Cannon and Brian Calvert, and it's called America But Better: The Canada Party Manifesto. Some great YouTubes from the Canada. And there's a lot of room up in Canada. Maybe a lot of people here could move up there.
Well, one of the plans we're looking at as a backup plan, if we don't win the presidency, is actually building a wall from our borders, kind of taking a page from the United States. It's not a bad idea, building a wall. And we're thinking about putting it on wheels, so as global warming approaches, we can just kind of roll it north and kind of maybe Canada secede from North America and declare itself the citizens of the Arctic and just roll that wall north as global warming kind of pushes the droughts north, and maybe have sort of an obstacle course on the south side so the Americans that don't have diabetes can make it over and, you know, become part of the new Canada. And on the a good friend of mine from the Tai'i suggested this whole idea. And on the north wall, we would simply have organic crops that we can feed ourselves on layered through tier system on the north wall.
Look how considerate you all are. I mean, it's really something.
Well, we're members of the community. It's just as individuals as are members of their local community. Countries are citizens of the world. They're members of the community of the world. And you can't operate without an ear towards what the community has to say. And that's why we're doing this, is we're part of the international community, and we want to help America reclaim its greatness.
Okay. America But Better, the Canada Party Manifesto, and check it out. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much. It was great being here. I'm glad I was in the neighborhood.
Okay. All right. Thank you. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and you really should get this book. It's really like hysterical, and it's a very funny book. It's the best kind of satire, political satire. I have all kinds of articles here that I was going to read about, but since they all set me off on some long sermon or a rant, all of which would be perfectly justified, I can't get into them now. But I would urge all of you to, the book is already up there. There's a mention of the book, America But Better, on the Occupied Territory website. Also, tune in to the other show I do, which is on Mondays at 4 p.m. It's called The Turning Point, in which I just get on and talk about virtually anything that I feel like it, and hope that it makes sense and it's interesting. One thing I guess I could mention before I get off is this LIBOR scandal, which some of you may be beginning to understand and read about, LIBOR, which it's an acronym for some gigantic bank exchange system based in London, is turning out to be the final, most gigantic, fraudulent banking scam in history. The mortgage thing and the lending and the gambling on derivatives is nothing compared to this. This is trillions of dollars were stolen from the rest of the people of the world while they're telling all of us and everybody in the rest of the world to clamp down and, to accept austerity and to have less, less money in our pensions, no health plan, to retire when we're 89 or whatever it is. All the rich people want us to do this. And this LIBOR scandal is the biggest thing around. But you will never hear reporting at all, hardly any at all, about the LIBOR scandal on any major networks anywhere, especially major television networks. And why? Because the CEOs and the presidents of these corporations are all intertwined, and J.P. Morgan, one of the worst, scandalous, most vicious perpetrators in the LIBOR scandal, is on the board of directors. These people are on the interlocking boards of directors. That is why the news on television is utterly useless. If you're watching the news on television, you are actually poisoning your brain. You're actually destroying brain cells. There is nothing on there that isn't actually dictated by the corporations that have ruined your life in every other way. Seriously. I mean, and I'm going to put some details on the Occupied Territory Facebook page to let you know about this, an article I just got. They own the networks, and you're not going to find out. J.P. Morgan controls one of the networks through other companies that do own the actual networks and run them. So that's it for today. America But Better. Yeah, American exceptionalism. It's a sad time to be an American. It's a very, very sad time to be an American. But don't forget, in November, we have a choice between two different murderers and liars. So, you get your choice to see who you want to be president. And tune in. We will be back next week.